Listening to KBOO Portland. The music you just heard was Sam Cooke in his classic, A Change is Going to Come. Today on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we are celebrating the 158th anniversary of Juneteenth, also known as Freedom Day or Emancipation Day. In 1865, it marked the end of chattel slavery. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I'll be your host for the hour. Please help keep shows like the Old Mole Variety Hour on the air by donating to your community radio station, KBOO. You can donate by texting KBOO to 44321 or by going to kboo.fm/give. We are one of the very few communities in the U.S. that continues to support non-commercial community radio. In honor of Juneteenth, we begin this morning with Sky Wilson interviewing Kent Ford about Juneteenth, the hard-won gains of the George Floyd uprising, and the critical importance of street protests in liberation struggles. Following that, we bring you a commentary from our archives by Clayton Morgridge about the abolition of slavery as an assault on property rights. Sharon Grant, our well-read Red, reads from an article about the concept of woke, where it came from and how it's been trashed. We'll close the show with Bill Resnick interviewing Jake Werner about the current saber-rattling between global giants, the U.S. and China. First up, Sky Wilson interviews Portland Black Panthers co-founder Kent Ford about the history and the current state of the struggle for Black liberation here in Portland and elsewhere. Our guest interviewer, Sky Wilson, is the equity manager for Multnomah County.
Hello, my name is Sky Wilson. It's my honor to be here today on the Old Mole to interview Mr. Kent Ford. Kent Ford is a founding member of the Portland, Oregon chapter of the Black Panther Party. He's a longtime community activist, public intellectual, people's historian, and elder street fighting statesman. As a lifelong organizer in Portland, he helped organize the Fred Hampton Memorial People's Health Clinic to provide free healthcare to community members. He also organized and volunteered for years at the Panthers' Free Breakfast for Children program, which fed 125 school children a day. He continues to be a critical voice in our world that takes up issues ranging from poverty to racism, colonization to the prison industrial complex. He currently leads Black Panther legacy tours of Portland's Albina neighborhood. As Juneteenth approaches, and as we just passed the 3-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder, today we discuss topics ranging from the long tradition of the radical Black organizing to current decolonial activism. Welcome, Mr. Ford. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Thank you for having me.
In the last 3 years, we've seen an increase in popular and political discussions regarding Juneteenth. Many organizations recently began recognizing the holiday, and then in 2021, President Biden signed the Juneteenth National Independence Day Act, making Juneteenth a federal holiday. Of course, the energy to recognize Juneteenth didn't begin in any boardroom or on a congressional floor. Would you please speak about the long history of Juneteenth and the link between organizing to protest the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers and the politics of recognizing Juneteenth as a federal holiday?
Excellent question, young man. Juneteenth goes back over 100 years after slavery and it basically was a national holiday, a state holiday in Texas. But after they dusted George Floyd Memorial Day and 3 years ago that you alluded to, it elevated it to a national holiday. Just that quick, I knew guys, some of the guys over the years, they even named themselves Juneteenth. And it was celebrated in communities, individual communities, but who would have thought, you know, in just 3 years, 1 year after George Floyd, that we would make it a national holiday, you know, and just overnight. It's just going to show you the power of street protests and mass movements. People that's been in the struggle for generations, like Angela Davis, you know, Karen Anderson, all these people, they never wavered. And these were the biggest protests, Sky, in American history, like in a couple of hundred for being over 8,000. And not just in America, but for the world. The state of Oregon set the standard, not just for the United States, but for the world. They sustained the protests for over 100 days. And I want to say this, and I'm not stretching it. I live this, and I see it from day to day, and I see how slow things can move, and I see how fast things can move. More progress has been made since the death of George Floyd on Memorial Day in 2020 than civil rights accomplished in over 50 years. We're still fighting the voter suppression, gerrymandering. You can get 18 months of just hanging out, handing out water at the polls in the state of Georgia. And we're still fighting the same thing with the 1964 Civil Rights Act that we've battled over ever since 1964, during the administration of Lyndon Johnson, from Dr. King to Malcolm to all icon guys that set the standards for us. And I don't think I'm stretching it. You know, I live this and I've seen it and I've seen what, but that's how quick things can happen. You could see even the Black Lives Matters printed on the streets from the spaceships in space, in downtown Washington, D.C. And these were the biggest protests in American history. And I'm not just saying this off of my head. This comes from the mainstream newspapers, the Washington Post, the New York Times. Take it back to 1958, when Malcolm was first getting his footage in America. Over 2,000 mainstream American newspapers. You didn't have not one Black reporter. This was in the late 50s. And then when the 60s came along, their wives were afraid to come into the neighborhood to cover what was going on in the Black community. So that's when they had a lot of Black reporters. The same way with the colleges, the universities, the corporations, Nike's, Adidas, the big corporations have budgets big as half of the a lot of the world's countries had to recognize, you know, something had to be done. And so they started reaching out to colleges and universities and grad schools, recruiting people to come out and hit the colleges and universities. But Oregon has always been a good state for this, for some of the mainstream colleges and universities. You take Portland University, for example. They recruited a lady out of Harvard University grad school to come out to run a foreign exchange program. And with that said, you know, and this was all not through legislation, all from the streets, from the protests. And I love guys like you guys, your PhDs, the scholars, the writers, the researchers, and all these. I love all you guys. It all takes place right there on the street corner. Malcolm would say, let your blood run in the streets. And that's exactly what happened right after George Floyd. People started hitting the streets in massive numbers. And all these white supremacist statues and icon statues was coming down, and all, not just here, all over the world. The world will never be the same. The world will never be the same. Number seven, we want to immediately end the police brutality and murder of Black people. Sky, that was written by some Oakland Merritt College students in 1966. It's more valid today when it was written back then in 1966. 2023, they start tracking the murders in America in the year 2015, during the Obama administration, during our first Black president administration, every year it was 1,000 people being dusted by the police in America. Now, check this out. In the whole European Union, just last year, only 10 people got dusted by the police. In America, it was over 1,100. Yeah, you guys can fact check me on anything I say today.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Foran. Would you please speak about any connections you see between the history of Juneteenth and the Land Back movement?
Sure. Just yesterday, there was a beautiful article in The Guardian talking about the profit some of the major colleges and universities have made off slavery and the reparations and that's owed to the people of the world, colonized people of the world under slavery, the amount of profits that were made off the enslavement. And some of them have these, Harvard University, a lot of universities in England have these large endowments of funds, and now they are wondering how they got all these funds. And it was during colonization, during slavery. Just like they signed that act, Sky, Biden signed the act, making the Juneteenth a national holiday, he can do the same thing with the reparation thing. It's not going to be done during legislature, not the State House, not City Hall, and not the Congress or the Senate. Everything's going to come from the streets. Again, you know, I admire professors, the colleges, mainly the researchers. You guys been following those stories this week about the latest revelations about Dr. King and Malcolm X. You know, when he went to visit Coretta King. They had Dr. King in jail, and he went to visit Coretta, and he said, just tell him, you know, that if things don't work out his way, you know, I'm still going to go my way, you know. The historians, the scholars, the research, they want you to say, what makes you think that there was a division between these guys? But it wasn't, you know, and they even had back channels. And most of the back channels were through their wives. They took him to where Coretta lived at, and he wrote out the message for Dr. King to read, for Coretta to take to him, you know, when they had him in prison there, you know. And it was just 64 years ago, you had the Children's March. It's just an incredible story. During the Children's Crusade in Birmingham, Alabama, they broke the siege on segregation and the bus boycott and enabled Dr. King to get the Nobel Peace Prize. The New York Times, they had a reporter there, and he said he had covered World War II in Europe, but he had never seen nothing like the brutality he had seen in Birmingham, Alabama, during the Children's Crusade. This is America. Could you imagine that?
Thank you. Thank you. Last month marked the 3-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. For a time, his murder and the protests that followed focused the nation's attention on the intersection of racism, policing, and the allocation of public and state funds. What do you think is an especially important lesson from this time? What did it reveal?
Excellent question. Thanks for that question. First of all, you had the Portland Police, but that was the first year that the Portland Police Department never didn't get a budget increase. 2021, 22, 23, they got everything they asked for. They asked for body cameras, they complained about that. But even when you get the body cameras, that money go right into the police budgets, and they can do what they want with it. And they got they increased the purse for guys to sign up, but more policemen were resigning and everything because of the respect they were losing. You can give these guys the Pentagon's budget. After George Floyd, one of the most popular quotes in the street during the protest is, "I don't want to have to say another MF name," and we've said hundreds of them since then. Yeah, Breonna Taylor, you know, name after name after name after name. It kept Memphis, Kentucky, Louisville, you know, Texas, you name the state. you know, you're trying to get the police themselves, and get on these review boards and all that stuff. They block every police unions are so strong, they block everything, and then nothing can get done. So whoever controls the guns in the city controls the city, and that's pretty much where it's at. I go back over 60 years in Portland and dealing with the Portland Police Department. And in the old days, you go down and tell the police chief about police brutality, and he would get up and walk out. He said, "What's the matter? The black community don't want no police protection?" That wasn't even what it was about. In a 14-month period, you had six blacks got dusted by the police in a 14-month period. This was in the late 60s and early 70s. And nothing was never done about none of it. The police was able to keep their jobs. They were able to get their PERS and their retirements and everything. And this is how strong the union was. Well, what happened to George Floyd, that broke the siege on a lot of that, you know. We said, well, we got to do something. We had an 82-year-old nun, Sister Mary Jill, came all the way up from Mexico to be part of the Portland protests. And she stayed up here for 2 weeks. She was down at the protest every night at 6 o'clock in the evening. Sometimes she wouldn't leave until 12 until 2 o'clock in the morning. And she just wanted to be a part of it. 82 years old.
It's amazing. This next question has two parts. The first part is, what lessons, if any, do you think current organizers or politically involved folks should learn from the theory and practice of the Panthers?
Thank you for that question very much. You see, Sky, the party had its own buildings, and we had a 10-point platform and program, and we ran out, we ran our 10-point platform and program out of our buildings. We didn't run them out of Model Cities buildings. We didn't run them out of the city's buildings. We didn't run them out of the county buildings. We had our own meetings, and therefore the city didn't exactly know what to do. And then when we set up the people's health clinics, the dental clinics, the breakfast programs, ride the prison program. The biggest population in Salem at the time was the Oregon State Penitentiary. That's the second biggest black population in the state of Oregon at the time, and back in the 60s. We had land, bread, housing, and immediately in the police brutality and murder of black people. They came after us with everything they had, and they hit us with everything they had. This is what the walk-in tours are about. We go to where the health clinic was. We go to where the dental. We were the only chapter in America, and the party spread to over 30 cities, including the District of Columbia. But we were the only chapter to have a dental clinic. And that was because this dentist that went to St. Andrews and another dentist, Dr. Clarence Pruitt, who was actually a professor at the OHS Dental School. Everybody came forward. So many doctors came forward. Then that's when the dentists started coming forward and said, well, we want to help out. We want to do something for the community too. But I want to say this. And we go to the breakfast program. We go to these landmark sites now. And I want to go to Chicago for one quick second. In Chicago, they're going to make over 58 sites a national historical landmarks for where the Black Panther Party used to have the buildings and the sites, just to honor Mark Clark and Fred Hampton and the work that the Chicago Black Panther Party did. And I didn't know it here until recently, and it was in the last 3 or 4 months. They have been tracking Fred Hampton ever since he was 14 years old. And then Dr. King, you know, he was a good Jesus man, you know, and he loved the Bible and all this. But Kennedy, JFK thought they could pick his friends from him. And he was telling him some of his friends had communist ties and all this and that, and told him he couldn't associate with these people. But you could, a guy like Malcolm, you couldn't tell Malcolm who to have as a friend. He would never go for it. But Dr. King, he didn't know that JFK had already sicked his little brother, who was the attorney general on him, Robert F. Kennedy, to investigate, did he have any communist ties? So if he was subversive, and you didn't want to go to Vietnam, and you was against the system, And then when Muhammad Ali said, no Vietnamese ever called me that word. Well, the man that had his ear at the time was the man we call X, Malcolm X. Well, what did they do? They took his title away. He lost three years of fighting, the revenue and everything. And I had the privilege of meeting him one time, right here in Portland, Oregon. Well, and he had spoken at the Oregon State University the day before. But and he had to make a living then, going around to colleges and universities on a speaker circuit. It was 3 years later before the United States Supreme Court reinstated it, said they couldn't take his title away because he was an Islamic minister. But meanwhile, he had lost that 3 years as far as training and boxing and being the heavyweight champ of the world. He got the title back two or three times, but he helps his descendants, you know, for the wars of the empire, you know, Vietnam, Iraq, all the other countries that we've been involved in, you know, with wars of imperialism and racial domination and control.
Thank you, Mr. Ford, and happy birthday. I appreciate
Thank you.
Your time in the wisdom that the wisdom and history that you're sharing with us today. This is Sky Wilson with the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Sky Wilson and Kent Ford in conversation about Black liberation struggles in the U.S. A longer version of the interview will be posted on the webpage for the show. Thank you to Desiree Helligers for producing this segment. You are listening to KBOO Portland. On June 19, 1865, millions of enslaved people valued in the billions of dollars ceased to be property, a radical change in the economic relationship between workers and capital. In his commentary, Clayton Morgeridge explains further. This piece originally aired on KBOO on Juneteenth, 2017.
The guiding star of political action, from the old mole's point of view, is the democratic control and ownership of the wealth and resources required to produce our lives. That is, everything that falls under the heading of capital. Pretty much all of this capital is now, directly or indirectly, under the control of the wealthiest tenth of the top 1% of the population, or in the U.S., about 320,000 people. It is their interest in maintaining and expanding their power that dictates what the rest of us have to do, how we have to work in order to live. Genuinely radical political action always aims at chipping away at and eventually abolishing the power of the capitalist class and the basis of that power, the private ownership of capital. The goal is a world in which we all together decide how we shall live. This is what revolution is, fundamental change in the relations of property, and therefore of the conditions of labor. Now, to appreciate what it takes to make such a revolution, it is worth looking back at what has been called the Second American Revolution, the Civil War, and the abolition of slavery. With the end of the war and the passage of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, the right to own human beings as property was abolished. The result was that what had been property, almost 4 million enslaved people, valued at over $3 billion, or 18% of the total of all U.S. wealth, suddenly ceased to be property, and all that wealth vanished from the economy. This was a revolution more radical than the first one of 1776 because it worked a fundamental change in property relations. Let's look back at the debate over slavery and the principle of private property in the decades leading up to the Civil War. The Fifth Amendment to the Constitution declares that no one can be deprived of their property without due process of law. Now, did that mean that the nation could not deprive enslavers of their property in human beings? Did it mean government could not prohibit moving slaves into new territories? The main issue in the 1830s and 40s was whether the government had the right to stop the expansion of slavery into new territories by admitting new states to the Union as free states. Those who profited from slavery, not only those who owned and drove enslaved people in the South, but the many northern investors in slaves and cotton, knew that slavery could only thrive if it kept expanding to keep up with the world market in cotton. Abolitionists and others who opposed slavery also understood this and hoped to end it by confining it to where it already existed and by repealing the laws that required northern officials to return escaped slaves to their enslavers. In 1836, abolitionists were calling for Congress to use its power over federal territory to end the slave trade and even to ban slavery itself in the District of Columbia. Here is how the South responded, as described by historian Edward Baptist in his book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. South Carolina Senator John C. Calhoun responded to these anti-slavery demands with a speech that outlined a foundational idea. He told the Senate that the Fifth Amendment limited federal power over individuals' property by decreeing that no one could be deprived of his property without due process of law. Calhoun now proceeded to build a sweeping principle on the back of this sentence. Due process, he insisted, could mean only trial by jury of a specific criminal. What the abolitionists proposed was the opposite of due process, legislative fiat that erased the property claims of a whole class of people. And, said Calhoun, were not the slaves of this district property, and were not their enslavers a whole class of property owners? Presumably, Congress could not prevent people from buying or selling said property, since salability is usually one of property's characteristics. Baptist goes on, Calhoun was stating an idea that would eventually be known as the doctrine of substantive due process. The due process requirements to which the Constitution referred could not be fulfilled simply by passing a law, for a law that invaded the rights of property owners, ran up against something too fundamental for procedure to alter. In Calhoun's vision, the Fifth Amendment was a geological outcropping that confirmed that beneath the Constitution lay an underlying substantive tectonic plate of natural law that allowed owners to hold and use property. Now, in 1847, Calhoun went on to argue that the Fifth Amendment denied Congress any right to require that new states outlaw slavery, complaining, quote, resolved that the enactment of any law which should directly or by its effects deprive the citizens of any of the states of this Union from emigrating with their property into any of the territories of the United States would unjustly discriminate between citizens of slave states and citizens of free states, and would therefore be a violation of the Constitution. He implied that the federal government should actually pass laws to enact the institution of slavery on federal territory, for to do otherwise would be to deprive individual slave owners and indeed all Southern whites, who were, after all, potential property owners, of their rights to emigrate with their property. End of quote. Well, it took a civil war and a constitutional amendment to remove human beings from the category of private property and free them from the direct ownership of capital. But capital still owns and controls the wealth enslaved people created, and it continues to expropriate that so-called free labor today and to dictate the conditions of labor and life. To protect the rights of capital, the principle of substantive due process, protecting private property that was laid down by Calhoun, is very much with us today. As Edward Baptiste writes, after the Civil War, pro-big business legal thinkers from the North would, ironically enough, take up a version of Calhoun's idea. From the 1890s through the New Deal era, the Supreme Court repeatedly used substantive due process to strike down legislative attempts to regulate Gilded Age industry, protect workers' rights, or break up monopolies. Substantive due process shaped and continues to shape the political economy of the United States in enduring ways. End of quote. A good case can be made that reparations should be paid to the descendants of slaves for the wealth that was beaten and sweated out of them. But the wealth owned and controlled by the very wealthiest families rules our world to the extent that a recent study of political power concluded that the U.S. is a plutocracy. Expropriating that wealth and putting it in public hands, that is the next revolution. Abolishing the private ownership of human beings was not easy. Neither will be the abolition of private property in the wealth our labor creates. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That was Clayton Morgridge with his commentary on slavery, property, and revolution. A longtime member of the Old Mole Collective, Clayton died in 2020. Woke is a black slang term referring to the capacity to understand the nuances of racism. The term has been co-opted and twisted and stripped of its complexity. Sharon Grant reads from an article published in Unbanned on February 1, 2023 by Kathleen Newman Bremang.
This is Sharon Grant, and I am reading from the article, When Did Woke Lose Its Meaning and How Do We Get It Back? By Kathleen Newman Bremang. From the Unbothered Network. And it starts. In 2023, the Unbothered Network is exploring the efforts to censor Black stories across the country, the roots of what's happening, those who are being affected, and those who are on the ground fighting to stop it. The same chilling scene is playing out at school board meetings across the country. An angry mob of mostly white parents circle a podium. One defiantly stands in front of it, spewing rhetoric they likely learned on Fox News. They're yelling about banned books to protect children from indoctrination, in quotes, when they're the ones trying to brainwash a generation into believing racism doesn't exist and that history didn't happen. Inevitably, someone, the podium mouthpiece or a cry from the crowd, will utter the word on the center of the fight for censorship and the push against progress. Woke. The word woke is now at the center of the battle over books. A war against wokeness has turned into a war against Black history and sharing the true stories of the Black experience. Woke may feel like a term that has lost all coherent meaning or one that has been twisted so much it has bent into a slur, but its roots undoubtedly are Black. Woke used to belong to us. The word woke has long been used, especially among Black folks, to denote that a person should be informed of the nuances of racism and sensitive to the prevalence of anti-Black violence. This is from Candace Watt-Smith, associate professor of political science at Duke University and co-author of Stay Woke, A People's Guide to Making All Black Lives Matter. But as is historically typical, conservative reactions to Black political movements have sought to weaponize the words and concepts illuminated by Black and Brown freedom fighters, largely in an effort to undermine the efforts of social justice movements, end quote. Woke may feel like a term that has lost all coherent meaning, or one that has been twisted so much it is bent into a slur, but its roots undoubtedly are Black. There have been countless pieces in the past couple of years written about the word's origin. Most of them trace woke back to the 1923 works of Marcus Garvey, in which he calls on his readers to, quote, wake up Ethiopia, wake up Africa, end quote, a sentiment aimed to inspire political consciousness and social activism. Then in 1938, a protest song by Huddy Leadbetter, AKA Leadbelly, includes the phrase, Stay Woke, and describes the 1931 saga of a group of 9 Black teenagers in Scottsboro, Arkansas, who were accused of raping 2 white women, according to Vox. Then the roots of woke take us to 1962, when Black novelist William Melvin Kelly defined the word in the New York Times for the first time in print in his piece, If You're Woke, You Dig It. In 1965, Martin Luther King Jr. essentially gave a speech on wokeness at Oberlin College. Quote, the great challenge facing every individual graduating today is to remain awake through this social revolution, he said. Black women scholars, of course, have been using the word in their works for decades. It became synonymous with Black Lives Matter and the fight against police violence. But at its core, woke is a Black slang term, one used by Black communities to succinctly reference progressive thought and radical intention. It was a word to signify our quest for freedom. When Bridges described the co-opting of woke as a violation during our call, my breath hitched. There is something especially intrusive about seeing language formed in Black spaces sucked from us and spat back with such a vitriol. And it's always words or phrases that reference the power of Black voices. As journalist Eric Eiffel tweeted last year, quote, "Woke is a term of Black movements, and I'm not surprised to see this foundation erased from the word, even by well-meaning people," end quote. Cancel culture, woke, and critical race theory are three recent terms, recent in the discourse, but have all been around for decades that have sparked the most heated debates. They were all, uncoincidentally, coined by Black folks. And each phrase plays its part in the horrifying resurgence of book banning and censoring curricula in schools. Banning a book is literally canceling it. Learning wakes you up. To be woke in its intended meaning is to be aware and informed. The right-wing strategy seems to be to try to keep kids asleep for as long as possible so they become dormant participants in their oppression. With Governor Ron DeSantis' Stop Woke Act in Florida and relentless misuse by the right across the U.S., critical race theory seems to have become a stand-in for discussing race at all or teaching Black history at any level. If woke is now a placeholder for, quote, anything not white, end quote, then CRT is the same for, quote, any history that tells racists about themselves, end quote. And they've both been canceled. We're already seeing the pushback from teens like Christina Ellis from York County, Pennsylvania, who at 17 staged a protest with her peers when their teachers and librarians received a list of books, articles, and films that were banned from classrooms. Quote, books like Hidden Figures and Rosa Parks were banned. You know, they're well-known things, and there's nothing controversial about, you know, Black women in science, she says. It's very hard as an African-American student to sit in class and hear that your great uncle was in Mississippi and he was lynched. That's hard to hear, but I don't hide away from it. We are better with education. We are better with knowledge, end quote. It's sanitizing of American history by purging it of the truth of racial violence. And we would be kidding ourselves if we think it's just going to stop with the cleansing of racial violence against Black people, Bridges says of the efforts to ban books and curriculum. Quote, Native people are survivors of an attempted genocide. We had the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. We had Operation Wetback in the 1950s, where American citizens of Mexican origin were deported. We had the Japanese internment of World War II. America has had all of these spectacular instances of violence against racialized groups, and critical race theory and wokeness are terms that are being used to expunge those lessons about our history. And if we don't know our history, we're doomed to repeat it. This is Sharon Grant for the Old Mole Variety Hour, reading an excerpt from the article, When Did Woke Lose Its Meaning and How Do We Get It Back? By Kathleen Newman Bremang. Stay woke.
That was a clip from the song Redbone by Childish Gambino. Before that, Sharon Grant read excerpts from an article entitled When Did Woke Lose Its Meaning and How Do We Get It Back? By Kathleen Newman Bremang. A link to the full article is posted on the webpage for this show. Several top military officials are predicting that mutual U.S. and China military provocations will devolve into full-scale war within the next 2 years. As part of the new Cold War, China is also challenging U.S. hegemony. Bill Resnick speaks with Jake Werner of the Quincy Institute on how we got here and how war might be avoided.
Hi, Jake Werner. Welcome to KABU.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
Jake Werner is a research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Statecraft. His research and writing examines the emergence of great power conflict between the U.S. and China, and he develops policies to rebuild constructive relations. Jake is also a co-founder of Justices Global, a grassroots organizing project that advocates for reforms in the global economy, and is co-founder of the organization Critical China Scholars, a network of academics engaged in public education on Chinese politics and society. So, Jake, tell us about how the relationships fell apart and increasingly belligerent words and also actions ensued that, in fact, make the front pages of our newspapers that could escalate into the unthinkable war.
Yeah, it has been a really remarkable and terrifying erosion in the relationship, particularly since Trump was in power, but it started before that. I mark it a turning point at the 2008 financial crisis. The United States economy, of course, was really devastated. The Chinese economy was also badly damaged, but the Chinese economy recovered relatively quickly. And at the same time, Chinese government had been buying up a lot of U.S. Treasury bonds to store its foreign exchange earnings. So one of the, to me, symbolically important moments in the turn in the relationship was when Obama first visited China. Many of the headlines interpreted that visit as a supplicant going to bow down before China. And so you could see there already the sense that the sense of insecurity on the U.S. side, that this country that previously hadn't been taken seriously as a competitor or as a rival power suddenly seemed to be in the superior position. It's taken a long time for some of these negative feelings to develop and eventually become policy. And it really took Trump to catalyze all of this. But the tensions have been growing for quite a while. As China gets more powerful and as American power has weakened or eroded, there are all these economic tensions as Chinese businesses became competitive with American businesses and as access to the China market got harder for American businesses. And then there's increasingly a military component. Significant frictions developed in the South China Sea under Obama already, with China worried about the United States hemming it in militarily, and the United States worried that China was trying to take over the entire South China Sea. And most recently, and most dangerously, around Taiwan, an island that China claims as its own, even though it doesn't rule it, and that the United States has an interest in making sure that there's no coercive reunification between China and Taiwan. For many years, there had been a tacit agreement by the two sides to kind of let the status quo go, where Taiwan was self-ruled, but China maintained its claim on Taiwan. The United States agreed not to take steps that would permanently separate Taiwan from China formally. Increasingly, both sides don't believe that the other is committed to that status quo. And so across the full range of economic, military, and as well as cultural and political issues, you have questions around democracy and human rights, questions around American hegemony in the world. Each side thinks that the other is trying to diminish them, and they are taking actions that they think are defensive in nature that the other side regards as aggressive in nature. And both sides are having a hard time appreciating the sense of insecurity and threat that's being felt on the other side and are just lashing out against what they take to be aggressive moves by the other side. So the two sides are not communicating well. They find it very difficult to be empathetic to the concerns on the other side. And increasingly, they're militarizing their relationship, trying to exclude the other one from economic and military presence in the world. So it's been going in the wrong direction for quite a while, and that's starting to come to a head now.
Just on a day-to-day level, their military maneuvers by their warships and fighter planes are often shadowing one another. Dangerous accidents happen. And then there's the increasing hostile worlds, like my predictions of war. And of course, the military-industrial complex here is always looking for a dangerous threat that must be stopped, so they magnify the threat. Those kind of conflicts make vivid pictures on TV, so people see it for themselves, how China is so aggressive. And then there's the revival of antipathy towards China for stealing our jobs, rather than blaming the real culprits for globalization and problems of the American working class. Anyway, one thing that we have to talk about, I think, fairly briefly, Anthony Blinken's trip to discuss all of these problems. He's going to China very, very soon. In fact, before this interview airs, we're pre-recording.
He'll be having his meetings on Sunday and Monday.
Right. Tell us, you know, briefly what you think is not much is going to happen, is your sense, but what's your take on it?
Right. I mean, this is coming out of, this was, as the relationship deteriorated, and the relationship deteriorated quite a bit further after Biden took over and essentially kept all of the Trump policies, including really harsh tariffs and a lot of restrictions. For example, Chinese journalists, Trump had closed down consulates in China, and China had retaliated for each of these measures. So Biden essentially preserved even the Fulbright program, the educational exchange program Trump had closed down. This is a really inoffensive program to have American students studying in China that the Biden administration has declined to revive. So pretty much everything that Trump had done, the Biden administration kept on. But on top of that, then the Biden administration pursued further restrictions and did so with through effective outreach to American allies. The American allies are the most powerful and richest countries in the world. So that is particularly threatening to China. These are also, many of them are the former colonial powers. That makes them an issue of sensitivity in Chinese nationalism, because Chinese nationalism is built around the claim that the Chinese government is allowing China to stand up against and escape from imperialist domination. So the Biden administration pursued this agenda of further restricting China's economic and military power. It did so more effectively than the Trump administration, and that caused the relationship to decline ever further. So the first couple of years of the Biden administration, the relationship was near collapse. And then we got Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, made a trip to Taiwan that enraged the Chinese side, because it any sort of official contact in Taiwan sort of imply a recognition of the independent status of Taiwan. So this enraged China, and it pursued some military exercises around Taiwan that kind of were dry run at executing a blockade of the island. So this, I think, really alarmed the Biden administration that things were starting to run off the rails. They don't want a war. They do want to limit Chinese power and influence. They don't want a war. So after that point, the Biden administration started to switch in a more diplomatic direction. And the outcome of that was Xi Jinping and Joe Biden met last November in Bali as part of the G20 leader summit. They had a long conversation. They agreed that they didn't want to have conflict. They agreed that there were some areas that two countries could work on. And they talked about Blinken visiting China as follow-up to that. So that was scheduled for February. That visit, however, was canceled after the Chinese spy balloon suddenly appeared over continental United States. And so that led to another round of acrimony between the two sides.
That's really comic opera, that episode, that it was taken seriously. And
it was taken very seriously, particularly by members of Congress, used it to inflate the, if you will, the threat of China and demand confrontation. So the Biden administration didn't take it so seriously. And the Biden administration, I think, wanted to get the Blinken visit back on fairly quickly, but China responded very negatively and refused essentially to take calls from America for a couple months. So what has happened now, China is experiencing its own difficulties. The economy is not running very smoothly. China is very worried about getting cut out of the global economy and is also worried about the possibility of military conflict. Chinese leadership does not want that. So they have sort of gradually opened back up to the idea of high-level talks. And the Blinken visit now is, there's been a couple of high-level contacts. The Blinken visit is kind of the formal resumption of diplomacy between the two sides. But as you said, I am pretty pessimistic about whether any real progress on the deep differences between the two sides will come out of this visit. The U.S. side has said explicitly that it doesn't expect any real progress. They just want to stabilize things. Whether things can be stabilized when both sides, when each side regards the other as a potentially existential threat, I am skeptical that you can stabilize relations when you're dealing with that kind of a situation.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio, talking to Jake Werner of the Quincy Institute on statecraft. Tell us about Chinese worries and then about U.S. worries.
Right. So, of course, the Chinese Communist Party has this history, this anti-imperialist history of allowing China, which was victimized by the imperialist powers, especially Britain and Japan in the 19th and 20th centuries. The Communist Party has this claim to having made China strong. It stood up against imperialism. It took control over its territory, established its sovereignty. And under Mao Zedong in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it also stood on the side of anti-imperialist movements in the Third World, supported communist revolutions in Latin America and Africa and Southeast Asia. That's, of course, its history. A lot of that history was abandoned after Mao died and Deng Xiaoping took over in the late 70s. And China really found a place for itself within the U.S.-dominated system, especially free market globalization. But this whole time, in the 80s, 90s, and the aughts, the Chinese Communist Party still insisted on maintaining its autonomy within that system. So unlike a lot of other countries, a lot of other developing countries, it didn't take on a lot of foreign debt. It didn't allow its currency system to be open. It maintained capital controls. It maintained the power to set the value of its currency. It didn't allow free movement of capital in and out of the country by Chinese or foreigners. So the Chinese Communist Party, even as it dismantled the planned economy and reformed the system along free market lines, it gave up a lot of the control that the state had over the direction of the economy. Nonetheless, it maintained its ability to be autonomous within the system, and it maintained its commitment to managing the economy so that it would become increasingly wealthy and powerful. So rather than foreign investors bring capital to the country and exploiting cheap labor, and then once the workers start to get fed up with that condition and they start to organize and start to demand more, then the capital just leaves. That has happened to a lot of developing countries, and as a result, those countries never really develop. What China did was it offered really attractive terms to foreign capital, a gigantic workforce that was highly educated and well-disciplined, and the state would come in and repress any unrest if it should happen. The state would use its power to force workers to be good workers, to be exploited by capital, foreign capital. But then it made demands on foreign capital and said, you have to invest here. You have to invest in raising and upgrading the technology in the economy. You have to build out these sectors that will allow the economy to develop. And so the government managed this process in a way that allowed China to increase its wealth and also increase the standard of living in the country, which it had to do because it was afraid of unrest that could challenge the legitimacy and power of the Communist Party. It was able to unleash development in China that other countries within free market globalization were unable to achieve. So China found a place for itself within American-dominated free market globalization, but it did so on its own terms, and it rejected the U.S. claim to set the rules for everybody. So this, in turn, always upset the United States. The United States was constantly lecturing China about its human rights record, about it not doing enough to support American priorities like isolating North Korea or Iran, or supporting American initiatives in the Middle East, or accepting all of the free market doctrines that the United States wanted to spread all over the world. So there were these tensions all along between the two sides, with China really insisting on maintaining its autonomy and doing things in its own way, even though it was a free market way, it was its own way. And the United States resenting that. We had these tensions throughout this period, but because both sides were really invested in free market globalization and both sides, at least the people in charge, were benefiting from that, it was possible to maintain a pretty cooperative relationship. So what changed is that after 2008, that free market globalization broke down. It was no longer growing quickly. It was no longer, a lot of the free market doctrines were discredited. that led the United States to feel like everything was falling apart. A lot of American leaders who just took American power and free market doctrines and the particular concept they have of democracy and human rights, a lot of American leaders who took those just as sort of God-given, the proper way that the world should run, they were really disoriented when that whole system started to erode and they weren't able to put it back together again after 2008. And I think that the way, even though China didn't in any direct way cause any of these problems, because China had always stood out and not accepted American power and not been the kind of unrestricted free market paradise that American leaders imagined, China really stood as a symbol of something different. And a lot of American leaders, they have worked through their difficulty understanding the direction that the world has taken these last 15 years by blaming China. Like, China is identified as sort of a symbol of all of these problems that America is having. It stands for, you know, in their minds, China stands for authoritarianism. It stands for state control of the economy. It stands for rejection of the rules-based international order, which is the same thing as whatever the United States wants. So in some way, China is the symbol of all these problems for America, and we can fix these problems if we can just exclude China and diminish Chinese power and influence, limit the ability of its economy to grow. We can rebuild American leadership. We can rebuild democracy, human rights, free markets, if we can just unite behind excluding and diminishing China. So I think these are the dynamics that are in play. And of course, that determination to diminish and exclude China to the Chinese leadership, that's a revival of the history of foreign imperialism and the attempt to keep China subordinate forever. So even though the Chinese leadership is not anti-imperialist in the same way that the revolutionary leadership was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it still has the kind of instinctive revulsion against the idea that China could be permanently subordinated within the American system or cut out of the most advanced opportunities for Chinese growth, or the ability of the Chinese system to stake a claim and say, look, there should be room for diversity of different societies, shouldn't just be whatever the United States says. So you get a real incompatibility between these two sides. Both sides are capitalist. They both have free market institutions. They both have tremendous degrees of economic inequality. They both have weak labor movements. Government is generally not welcoming of stronger labor power on both sides. There are terrible racial inequality in both countries. There's terrible gender inequality in both countries. There's actually, the two countries actually have a lot in common, but it's very hard for them to recognize these commonalities because each one is envisioning the other as the primary obstacle to its own ability to grow and flourish and affirm its values.
Yeah, we have to conclude. Thanks, Jake Werner, for talking to us.
Wonderful talking to you.
Yeah, good talking to you.
That's it for our Juneteenth show. A special thanks to our guest interviewer, Sky Wilson, and to our other guests, Kent Ford and Jake Werner. I would like to thank Moles, Sharon Grant, and Bill Resnick for their contributions, John Nelson for his editing assistance, and Desiree Helligers for help with production and editing. As always, the Moles send their love and appreciation to the hardworking staff at KBOO. I'm going to leave you with Gil Scott-Heron. The revolution will not be televised. Thanks for listening, and stay woke.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised.